Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome to this special edition of Inside Scoop Live. I'm Irene Watson. I'm the managing editor of Reader Views in Austin, Texas. Our show's website is InsideScoopLive.com.
And I'm Victor Volkman from Loving Healing Press in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Tonight we're speaking with three authors from the just-released anthology, The Story That Must Be Told, True Tales of Transformation, Volume 1. On the line with us tonight are Peggy Fisher and Sylvia Dickey Smith.
And first, let me give you a little background into this project. It was about 12 months ago that Victor and I launched a short story contest for people to share their own personal tales of transformation. And as we know, transformation means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. For instance, there's forgiveness, and there's recovery, and there's courage, and these are just only a few of the themes that we have touched in the book.
That's right, and we were continually impressed as the contest entries arrived at how people triumphed over circumstances while at the same time lighting the way for others. That's why we're especially happy to be here online with two of our 19 authors whose stories appear in this new book from Loving Healing Press.
First of all, what I want to do is talk to Peggy. She has a story with the title of Lessons from the Wisdom Within. And the synopsis of her story is a woman's marital crisis in midlife spurs a brave new beginning through Eastern practices. And through her experience, she actually discovers the inner wisdom and the courage to change. And what I'm going to do now is just read a little passage and ask Peggy to give us a little bit more detail on how this really occurs. And so the passage is, "There are many paths that we can travel to access our divine light. I just happened to choose yoga, or perhaps yoga found me. Some people begin their journey by observing sunrise and sunset. For others, it might be a quiet walk, a beautiful painting, or other restorative gateways." Now, Peggy, you chose yoga, or perhaps, as you say, yoga chose you. And why do you feel that this was what really resonated for you?
This is Peggy. I suppose because I'm the type of person that is hard to come to grips with anything, and because yoga was so practical in terms of physical kind rather than a mental kind, because I had done all the mental things. So the physical just happened to be in line with my spirit.
And when you talk about mental, what all the things did you do that you felt just sort of you came to an end and you needed to go further, and you obviously turned into the spiritual direction. So what were some of the mental things that you had practiced?
Well, I had read every psychological textbook that I had previously because I was a clinical specialist. I had reviewed everything on depression and had gone through so many things in terms of mental activity trying to resolve my problem. But nothing seemed to happen. And yoga, when I started experiencing the first night, I knew that it was perhaps my gateway. And then, of course, I got into transcendental meditation.
Ah, I like the word gateway because it certainly, yoga is a gateway and basically an umbrella of so many other things, isn't it?
Yes.
You had mentioned, Peggy, that about depression. Were you depressed?
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't sleep. Sleep never really resonated with me. I'd get up in the morning exhausted, and sometimes at night I would be waiting for the morning just to activate myself. Yeah, I knew I was depressed. Mm-hmm. There was no doubt in my mind. But I didn't want to seek psychiatric help because I thought I could solve my own problem. And to be honest with you, I couldn't rely on a psychiatrist. I'd worked with them so many years in terms of getting my degree and so forth. So I thought I could resolve it before they could.
That's an interesting, because I think that most of us that have a background in psychology or therapy of some sort have the same feeling, don't we? And
yeah.
So you were in a marital crisis.
Yes.
And you chose to do your transformation through the Eastern philosophy. Tell me how that resonated more with you as compared to the Western philosophies.
It was something that I could do on a daily basis, which I did. actually twice a day. It's something that you really can't describe because it has to resonate with you. You know, some people pray. I still pray. I still read the Bible. But it was getting into my inner self where I could listen to what I call the divine light, that which is our birthright, which really appealed to me because then I could use my power source to move further.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't need direction from other people because I was using my resources, and that was very important to me.
Yes, and that's really the bottom line, isn't it? It's whatever is important to you. Now, from what I gather is you ended up going through a divorce. Is that correct?
No, we actually separated for 4 years.
Oh, okay.
And we went back to our marriage life, such as it was, but within 3 years, we separated again. I never divorced,
mm-hmm.
but 10 years down the road, he succumbed to cancer of the lung. So that's how our marriage ended.
Uh-huh.
Okay, Peggy, you've been doing the meditation, I guess, for about 30 years. I'm just wondering, on a day-to-day basis, what are some of the things that the benefits that you feel like every day out of this work?
Well, you know, when I finish my meditation, I'm usually calm. I can focus more. Through the years, I've learned how to take care of my health. I exercise on a regular basis in addition to my yoga. I do complementary medicine because I do have, I am a nurse, ex-nurse, and I'm aware of what I'm doing in terms of if I'm taking something negative into my body, and sugar is my problem, I immediately recognize it. That doesn't mean that I live a perfect life in terms of my cravings, but I have learned to decrease my craving for sugar and do less in terms of my hectic pace. I've always been a type A person, so it slows me down and makes me focus on what I need to do rather than, as I said in my manuscript, I try to focus on what I need to do. Even though I'm a caregiver for several people, I don't let other people into that space too often because I just don't have the time.
Well, we can certainly understand that, that's for sure, and it's great to find that you have found something that works. And on the other hand, we have Sylvia Dickey Smith. Her title of her story is Divorcing God, an interesting, interesting title. And so we're going to talk a little bit more on her story, but I want to read a passage, too, that just really kind of got me. And Sylvia writes, "Over time, I learned to stand up for myself, claim what I believed, what I stood for, what I didn't stand for, and what I absolutely would not tolerate. And, as you might expect, this took a severe toll on my marriage. One day, my husband confronted me, asking, 'Can't you go back and be like you used to be?' Oh, my, my, Sylvia, that must have been quite a blow."
Hi, this is Sylvia.
Yes, it was, because I knew if I did that, I would die. When he said that, I knew my body may survive if I tried to be what he wanted me to be, but I knew my soul would be gone. And it was just like, and many people said to me at that time, you know, or later, how brave I was in leaving that marriage, because it doesn't happen very often that you leave a marriage married to a minister. And yet I didn't feel brave at the time. I just felt like I wanted to live. So I really enjoyed listening, Peggy, to what you were saying, because I resonated a lot with what you were saying. And much of that sort of self-discovery for me came after the marriage ended rather than before.
You had the strength, though, to say, no, this is not going to work for me. And you left the marriage because you were actually looking after your own self. And
right. I knew I couldn't be me and be in the marriage. To be in the marriage, I had to be his definition of who I should be. And I had married really young. I'd married at 17, and he was a few years older than me. So I really kind of felt like I was shaped and molded into be the person that fit the role. And over the years, when a real crisis came in my life, and I mentioned that in the story, when my dad died when I was 40, and I just started going to college, and I remember hearing my mom say to people who called sympathy, and you know, how she couldn't get through that if it wasn't for Jesus being right there with her. And here I was, a minister's wife, and I had ministered to people, or thought I had, all those years, and yet I didn't feel a thing. You know, I felt abandoned by God, and I didn't understand that. And that sent me on a personal quest or a journey. I started asking questions instead of settling for answers. And I think all my life before that, I had just accepted the answers that people gave me. That's why I needed to decide what I stood for and what I believed and didn't believe. And I needed to ask the questions that I hadn't asked. And it's like now I don't even look for answers. I'm thrilled with the questions. Questions just spur me on and inspire me and make me want to learn more and more. And I have done yoga, and I found it really helping me get in touch with my body for the first time. I've been out of touch with my body all those years, and I'm not currently doing it, although I sort of like Peggy with her sugar. I don't do it perfectly. I need to get back to doing it because it did help me so much in so many ways.
Well, yoga certainly, and any of the meditations, so on, helps us focus, for sure. And as I'm listening to you talking, and you mentioned that you were married to a minister and at the age of 17, and so there was just that huge expectation of you also as being a minister's wife. And you, I'm sure, were envisioned by the congregation, by others, a certain way, and obviously that's not who you were. And it's just incredible that you were able to at one point say, hey, this does not work. And I'm really curious, what was that point? There's always a point that something happens, and there's either a feeling or, you know, one of those aha moments. And I'd like to know what that aha moment was of yours.
I don't know if it was a moment or an accumulation. As I said, I started going to college myself at 40, and I too became a psychologist. And I think we choose those things to learn the lessons that we need to learn. But I discovered, I did a lot of reading of women's issues. I became very much an outspoken person for feminist issues within my world, which was didn't make me real popular with a lot of the men in my world, but much with their wives. But the more I began to question, and the more I began to find my own answers, and the more I became the person that was comfortable for me, and the more that didn't fit my ex and his need for me to stay in that. And I just kind of eased out of that marriage. My daughter was going through a crisis at the time. She was in high school, and we needed to get her in another high school. And so I kind of eased into a separation, and I've apologized to her since for using her as a little bit of an excuse to move out of the house and into an apartment to get her into another school. It was kind of like it took a step by step by step by step out of it rather than just one event that put me over the limit. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
No, Sylvia, that's a very good point. I mean, for some people, it all happens in an instant, and for others of us, we just slug away at it over days, weeks, and months, and then finally we're through
it. Yes, right. And when you say, I can't, you know, and my ex asked me if, you know, didn't I think I would get more like I used to be, you know, go through all this crisis and, you know, get over it and get to be the person that you used to be. And I said, you know, I probably will get closer back that way, but there are no guarantees when, where, how, and how much. And so at that point, we decided we needed to go different ways because of that.
Yeah.
So I basically left that denomination.
Got it. So, of course, there was a crisis of faith involved. I'm just wondering, since then, how your personal relationship with God has evolved and how you kind of see things from today's viewpoint.
Very much a religious, spiritual crisis at that point. I kind of made an agreement with God for several years that I wouldn't go to church and he wouldn't bug me about it because I couldn't go and be me. I kept, when I would go, I would feel like I was more the other person or trying, I should be the other person.
Uh-huh.
There was a really emotional connection that I had with hymns and prayers. And so I started on a journey, a faith journey. I won't say that I became the person I was before in my spiritual faith. My spirituality is much more separated from any religious leanings than the spiritual leanings. I attend church. I attend a Methodist church, and my first husband was a Baptist minister, so I attend a Methodist church, but I don't feel Methodist. I feel like I'm me, and I stand for what I stand for, and don't stand for what I refuse to stand for, and speak out when I need to on those issues that I think are vital to our spiritual faith journey.
That's
I keep asking questions.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you have any advice for any young women today who might be in a similar position as to you, where you were back then.
If they were in my position as I was then, I would say look for your own answers. Look for that resonates within inside you. Don't accept easy solutions. I personally think being a minister's wife is the hardest job in the world because of the expectations. And so stepping outside those expectations and looking for who you are. I think you can successfully be a minister's wife, but you have to know who you are deep inside. So find that thread. Look for other people. It's a real isolated position, I think, because of the expectations from the community. So look for a network of people, of women that can walk with you through some of those struggles.
You know, as I'm listening to you, Sylvia, saying that, you know, the expectation of a minister's wife, I can't even imagine what it would be like, but it must be a very, very lonely place to be in because the perfection is expected.
Right.
By the congregation, by anybody that all of a sudden realizes that you're the minister's wife. It just puts you up on this pedestal, and you almost don't even become a person. This is, you know, what my feeling would be.
You said that very well. I remember perfectly. It is a very lonely position. And just in the last couple of years, I've started a Yahoo group. We call it Preacher's Wives Anonymous, and it's where we can go on and share with other preacher's wives or ex-preacher's wives to have someone to listen to that can truly understand what it's like, a safe place to talk to other people. There's not very many places like that for a minister's wife and for their children. It's a very difficult life for the children as well. So many children that are children of a minister rebel and cause problems because of that expectation and that loneliness I think they have of being perfect and saying the right thing, looking the right way, going the right places. It's a tough world.
It's a very tough world. It's
families
a very...
in that, yes. And I don't think it is known. I don't think it's public knowledge like it needs to be for congregations. I think we can help congregations become more sensitive to that.
Yeah, you know, I so agree. Just some of my experience that I've had, and I don't know what it is, if it's fear-based or what it is. Peggy,
I'm sitting here thinking.
Thinking, yeah. What are you thinking? I know you're thinking.
What resonated me in terms of what Sylvia said is the universality of faith.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go to church on a regular basis, even though I was raised in the Methodist faith. And I think some people look at me sometimes when I say that if we don't come to grips with every religion has good people and bad people. And when we look down on another person's religion, we are creating some of the climate in the society that we live in. So I believe in the universality of faith. And this sometimes causes people to look at me and say, oh, well, she's not a Christian. Well, if that be the case, then I suppose I'm not. But I think being a Christian or being a good person, being a person who is full of grace is much more important than the label you put on in terms of religious faith. And that's, to me, that's what has been resonating with what Sylvia said, although it may have been said in a different way than I'm putting it.
You put it, this is Sylvia, and you put it beautifully, Peggy. I agree with you. I agree with you.
And what I'm hearing is both of you found a safe place within yourselves to create that space and those feelings and the spirituality. And what I want to ask both of you now is, do you feel that transformation piggybacks on spirituality, or does spirituality piggyback on transformation? Are they both there? Is there a bottom line that it is spirituality when you transform or the other way around? I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Which one first?
Sylvia, you can go ahead.
Sure, Sylvia, go ahead.
Well, I do think they're piggybacked. I don't know if you can have one without the other. I feel like my spirituality is like a teenager. I threw out everything I had been taught at that point and started looking at it again and building it again and finding a real deep spiritual base. But all along, all of that is the transformation that occurs. Peggy?
I agree. This is Peggy. I agree that they sort of are on the same continuum, if you want to call it, and one enhances the other. You have to be transformed, in a sense, in order to appreciate the fullness of spirituality. And that's about all I can say.
I think they go hand in hand, and yet I'm not even real sure you can separate them.
Exactly.
Right.
But it's a wonderful walk to be on. That's all I can say.
Absolutely.
It's a wonderful walk.
Well, you know, as I'm listening to both of you, and it's interesting because I'm sure that you've never met each other, and yet there is that connection and there's that spirituality of the both have, you know, the same type of base, the bottom line base of spirituality that enhanced your transformation. And what I'm also hearing, both of you have this wonderful strength that you were able to find, I guess, for lack of another word, because both of you were in situations that were just very traumatic. And, you know, one of you, I know, was contemplating suicide. Maybe both of you were, but I know one of you were. And, you know, that's really being down at the scraping at the bottom. But look where you are now. And I just want to really commend you. And I want to thank you both for sharing your stories, because this is just something that people really, really need to hear. And it's been wonderful talking to you. And I commend you for writing the stories. I commend you for letting people know your experiences. That is so important, to let people hear your story, because that's how they learn and that's how they get strength, is from your own strength. Thank you both so much.
Well, thank you, Irene and Victor. I was thrilled to have an opportunity to tell my story.
I want to thank Victor and Irene. And denial is our worst enemy. That's all I want to add.
Oh, yes. And it's not that river, is it?
No. Thank you so much.
You're
thank
quite
you.
Welcome. I'd like to remind our listeners that they've been listening to a special edition of Inside Scoop Live, presented by Reader Views Incorporated at www.insidescooplive.com. You can learn more about this book and read a sample story at www.lovinghealing.com/truetales. The story that must be told, True Tales of Transformation, is available now from Amazon.com and other fine online bookstores. For Loving Healing Press, this is Victor Volkman in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
And from Reader Views in Austin, Texas, this is Irene Watson signing off.
Thank you for listening, and remember, what one person achieves creates a new possibility for everyone in what it is to be human.